We are starting the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and story, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. In today's show, we start with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Witness Tree. And then I interview George Serra and play several selections from his album Vicissitudes. And then an interview with Catherine Allison and Madame Chocolat. Stay tuned!
She stood over 90 feet tall, and her branches spread out at least that wide. Her lower branches hung down, almost touching the ground. You'd have to stoop to walk under them. Her main trunk was over 6 feet thick. Her bark was rough. She was hundreds of years old. She was a valley oak or Quercus lobata. According to the young park ranger on duty, the tree in question was called the Witness Tree, because it had been around for hundreds of years and had been witness to everything from the Chumash Indians to 60 years of the Topanga banjo and fiddle contest. The Witness Tree was there when Paramount Ranch's western town was used as a location to film The Maid of Salem, The Adventures of Marco Polo, Ebb Tide, Wells Fargo, Dick Powell's Zane Grey Theater, Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and Johnny Cash's Variety Show. The Witness Tree was there to hear the Cisco Kid say, "Oh, Pancho," and Pancho reply, "Oh, Cisco," if this tree could have talked. On November 9th, 2018, the Wellesley Fire roared through the Santa Monica Mountains and burned most of Western Town to the ground. Western Town had been built up around the Witness Tree. The tree's grandeur can be seen in all the above-listed movies, TV shows, and many other productions. The Witness Tree was burned horribly. Its proximity to all the buildings in Western Town was its final undoing. Quercus lobata are fire-resistant. The Woolsey Fire is certainly not the first fire the Witness Tree had ever endured in its hundreds of years. Fire is part of the Southern California ecology. As residents of Southern California, we are fortunate to live in a Mediterranean climate. We have cool, moist winters followed by hot, dry summers. Whatever grows up in the moist winter and spring will most likely die in the summer and make for great fire fuel in the summer. It has been that way here for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The problem is, the hotter it gets, the bigger the inevitable fires get. In California, 15 of the largest fires in recorded history have happened in the last 20 years. In the case of the Witness Tree, Western Town was built up alongside it. When the fire came, it was not a ground fire, but instead high up in the buildings. The wooden movie set went up in flames, burning high up into the Witness Tree, killing it. The dance barn was right next to the Witness Tree. My daughter Mika's various bluegrass bands used to compete in the dance barn for the preliminary competition. Lots of great memories in that building. Several years ago, one of her bandmates had a huge multicolored mohawk haircut. I'd be willing to bet cash money that Marcus's mohawk was the first to ever appear at the Topanga Banjo and Fiddle Contest. There were three buildings inside Paramount Ranch that did not burn: the bathroom in the parking lot, the railroad stage, and the country church with its Gothic Revival doors and windows. The country church is painted beige with dark brown trim. Just beyond it stands another large valley oak. Not as big as the witness tree, but big. Mother Nature is strange. After the Woolsey fire, we had one of the wettest winters in years. Mother Nature is already bouncing back. The denuded hills of the Santa Monica Mountains are now lush with wildflowers and vegetation. The animals that survived the fire are now having a great salad fest. If you take a walk along one of the trails that lead from the Paramount Ranch into the mountains, as soon as you get over the crest of the hills and get out of sight of the ranch, you might as well be back in time 1,000 years. Mountain lions are no fantasy here. They are real. And those bunny rabbits that are eating all the new grass and vegetation are making for fat rabbit meals for lions, coyotes, and bobcats. We went to the Paramount Ranch a few years ago for the Topanga Banjo and Fiddle contest. Mika had been competing there for years. Her band for a few years was named the Fiddlers of Troy. It had been made up of USC students and graduates. The USC mascot is a Trojan, hence the Fiddlers of Troy. Mika competed for 7 years at the Topanga Banjo and Fiddle contest. The Fiddlers of Troy placed second. They missed first place by half a point. Some of the past winners of the Topanga Banjo and Fiddle contest include Steve Martin, David Lindley, Taj Mahal, Jackson Brown. It's an impressive list. One of the things I remember about the festivals of my youth is that some of the best music was happening in the parking lot, or wherever people that loved bluegrass music would gather to jam. This has not changed in 50 years. While walking around Paramount Ranch, I heard about 20 different groups just playing for the joy of playing under the shade of some of the oak trees that did not get burned in the fire. I've seen millions of dollars worth of Martin guitars, every model of Deering banjo made, many dobros, mandolins by the dozens, the A-style, the F-style, stand-up basses, and hundreds of fiddles. There is a luthier on site just in case something broke. Some of these instruments are hundreds of years old. Stuff breaks. The next Topanga Banjo and Fiddle contest will be the 60th. It happens on Sunday, May 15th at Paramount Ranch. Put it in your calendar now.
It is March 22nd, 2022. That's kind of a neat number. 32222.
That's my birthday.
Today's your birthday? We can pretend it's your birthday.
No.
No.
Well, I would be one day old.
Oh, you were born yesterday?
No, I was born today. Is today the 22nd?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't look a day over 40.
Really?
And you're one day old.
Yeah, I know.
This is George Sarah with Mystic Pete. We're old buddies. You've been on my show a bunch of times. You are an important musician and composer, and right now getting very well known for your score to the... Wait, it'll get me. I know this.
It's ready? You got your finger on it.
I have the old computer chip in my head. It's the 286.
Yeah.
And some of the memory circuits don't work well. Mm-hmm. Joan of Arc.
Yes.
You are touring around with a live orchestra to this incredible 1920s silent film. The film alone is just unbelievable, but with your score, it's double unbelievable. It's really good. So that's kind of what's happening right now, but you're going to tell us more about what's happening.
Yes. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Oh, good. But where I wanted to start is at the bottom.
Yes, literally.
You had confided in me that you had kind of a revelation in jail. So this is the artistic journey, the journey of music. We all have to be in jail at some point.
Exactly.
Metaphorically. Yeah. So how did you get in jail? What happened?
So I used to drink quite a bit. And at one point in my life, in my mid-20s, I had accumulated 4 DUIs. And it was on my 4th DUI, I totaled my car. And I blacked out. I don't remember the accident. And I didn't injure anyone, you know, thank God. But so I woke up and my car was completely mangled. It was in two pieces and I hit a bus bench and the bus bench was completely... And I walked to a payphone. You know, this is in the 90s. So I walked to a payphone, called 911, and I was like, I've been driving. I caused an accident. I need to go to jail. And I was completely like out of my, you know, drunk at that time, you know, and so I got thrown in jail for that. The cops came, and I said, yeah, you know, it's me, and, you know, they arrested me, and I had to spend the night in jail. And while I was in jail, it's when I quit drinking. At this moment of clarity, I guess you could say, I heard a voice. I was actually in jail and like an alcoholic. I was like, you know, I don't think I have a problem. I think I'm gonna switch to wine. I'm only gonna drink on the weekends. And then I heard a voice that said, "You'll stop." And I turned around. And when you get thrown in jail for like being intoxicated, they usually put you in a single cell because they don't like to have a bunch of drunk people in a cell to, you know, fight and stuff, right? So I was in there by myself in this cell, a single cell, so there's no one else in there. And so when I heard this voice, I turned around, and that desire completely left my body. And I've been sober since, and I don't even get tempted, so, which is kind of nice. I mean, that's my thing. I know when other people who struggle with addiction, they go to meetings and stuff, and I completely understand and I encourage that because my path was like unpredictable. It's very unusual. It's not, I can't say this is what's going to happen to other people because I don't know anyone else. You know, this is not, you know, a common thing. I've literally never met a single person that said, yeah, I heard a voice too. You know, it just didn't happen. So I'm not going to say wait till you're, and then get, you know, it's like, no, if you have a problem, you know, go to meetings and stuff, you know. But yeah, so that's what happened to me, and that's what got me. The desire left. Like, I just don't ever think about it or want it. And prior to that, I was like, it was a daily thing, you know. I was 4 DUIs in 2 years. And I was also lucky because the following year, the laws had changed, and if you get 4 DUIs, it becomes a felony. So I I don't have a felony on my record, so it's like completely wiped. No one would know unless you're listening to this.
You're right.
Right.
Just between you and I.
Yeah. So if like a curator who's considering hiring me to perform at their venue.
Is this a reputable character for our institution?
Yeah. Well, on the plus side, usually when I do a show, you know, in the green room, they have like, you know, wine and beer and stuff. I usually give that away to the employees. So it kind of works out for them too.
That's nice.
Yeah, like custodians. I'm like, dude, come here.
Bouncer dude.
Bouncer dude. Hook him up. Yeah. Like whoever, you know, like anyone there, doesn't matter. They can be, or the curator, you know, just whoever wants it, here, go for it, you know, because they're not going to throw it away, but, you know, yeah.
Well, certainly addiction extends beyond the music community, but I understand about being sensitive, being an artist myself, being a musician. We are sensitive people, and it's a rough world to be in, and all this pressure combined with the fact that we're kind of different, we are visionaries, we're vibrating at a different frequency, we're our oddballs. Often the way us creative types deal with it is through self-medication. And sometimes that actually becomes a part of the music making. There are whole genres of music that are actually associated with, you know, rock and roll, alcohol, reggae, marijuana. Heroin has its own genres, but grunge or so. This is a journey a lot of artists go through, and somehow you hit rock bottom, and it's just been uphill since then.
Yeah, I think I've been more prolific, and since I quit drinking and I've been sober, because there is kind of this misunderstanding, this misconception that like you kind of need it to be a creative person. It's like, no, you're creative prior. Like I started playing music, and I knew I wanted to be a professional musician when I was 10, you know? And I didn't start to drink till I was like 17. So, and I was, when I was 14, I had a band in high school and we were writing our own songs. And it was like, so that party period was kind of brief. It was 10 years, but looking back now, I think that I experienced a lot of like trauma and abuse growing up. And I went to alcohol for it, but like as an adult now being sober, a lot of those issues exist. And you know, I read a book a few years ago called The Body Keeps the Score, and I've been in EMDR therapy, you know, and I realized that I have like PTSD, and which I didn't realize, because when I got sober a lot of my issues still were there. So in many ways you can like deal with these things, you know, in a healthy way, as opposed to turning to like substance, you know, because, yeah. That's just me personally.
As I get older, I learn to just relax more around my creative friends, and sometimes people are weird or acting out, you know, doing crazy stuff, but I get it. We're struggling to stay here, to be here. Yeah. And then you took your gifts and your inspiration and your passions and you worked hard. Then there's this other force in the world. Well, I just want to be famous. Yeah, I'm God's gift to the world. Mm-hmm. And they're seeking fame as, it's almost a sense of self-validation or wanting to feel special. But I think that's very different from the creative force.
Yeah.
And wanting to be famous isn't a strong enough motivation to see you through how difficult it's going to be to become a successful artist or musician. Yeah. It's not you will give up.
Yeah.
It's only if you have to be a musician.
Right.
Period. And because it's too hard.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could tell us a little about that. You've worked hard. You've paid your dues. You spent the hours and days and months, you know, figuring out music theory and this and that and scoring and playing on stage. And, like, there's a lot to it.
There's a lot to it. It never gets easier. I mean, maybe for some people, I'm once again talking from personal experience. But, you know, in 2008, I worked with Poetic Kinetic. That's the group in L.A. They do those astronauts at Coachella and stuff, and they asked me to collaborate with them for the Beijing Olympics, you know, and it was like a pretty big gig. You know, it was months. It was great money. And it was right after I completed like a series for the Discovery Network. So I felt like I was at a point where I had like, I was comfortable, you know, financially and stuff. And then after that, I was like on a dry spell for like 2 years. You know what I mean? So it's sort of like, you know, and it's, and even now that I, when I do my Joan of Arc film score, you know, I've been, before the pandemic, my last show was in Toronto, but I was playing different cities every week. I'd fly into Dallas, I'd fly into Milwaukee, string quartet and a choir, and I work with local musicians. I send them PDF of the charts and stuff, and working with some really great people and meeting great people around, you know, and then come back. And then, you know, I also have this other ensemble with myself and a string trio, and it's a little bit more industrial and stuff. And some of the CDs.
What's that one called?
Time Lapse. I mean, I know it's in the library at KXLU. I've heard it, on, you know, like recently, like someone played it on their afternoon show. I was like, yes, thank you. But anyway, so even no matter what, you know, you did this U.S. tour. And I had a film come out last year during the pandemic. It was called Her Name Was Joe. It's on Amazon Prime. It's free. It went to the film festivals and it won a bunch of awards. And I scored it. And that soundtrack's more Americana and ambient and stuff. And that's the one you have, Vicissitudes. That's pieces from that. And even with all that, you know, it's like I still get people who act like I'm bugging them, or I'll have, you know, a musician will tell me like I'm not legitimate because I taught myself kind of how to do string arrangements and stuff, and you know I refined it so it gets to, you know, but there's certain things I'm not going to know. And I guess what my point is that no matter what happens, you're there's still something kind of pulling you down.
It's hard.
It's never easy. Yeah, never easy.
Someone I know, I personally know a number of people who have come to LA thinking, oh, I'm going to show up there and I'm going to be a famous model, photographer, musician. So like, oh, I'm going to show up and be a star.
Yeah.
What we know, you and I know this, nobody ever shows up and makes you famous.
Right.
It's not going to happen. Maybe one in a billion if you're pretty enough. But normally the world will ignore you or poke at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure any possible insult or criticism, any possible criticism that you could have received, you've received.
Mm-hmm.
People just trying to be know-it-alls or thinking they're helping you or just being jerks, they're giving that kind of poison to you. And we're dealing with this all the time. So we have to learn how to like, oh, thank you for your opinion. Because you don't want to like start a fight with them when they're telling you how to do your string arrangement.
Right.
Thank you. But, you know, we get a thick skin after a while.
I don't know if maybe this has anything to do with it, but I truly have this. It's not a mantra. Well, it's like I don't ever dislike something I see on social media, and I never comment on anything. Unless it's like a thumbs up or something. Once I did that and I felt like I was started to go down a rabbit hole.
Oh, to be critical.
Yeah. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but just me personally, I felt like somehow that's just made me, I don't know, feel like less on my shoulders. I don't know.
Even
when people attack me, and people have attacked me, like not physically, but, you know, made stuff verbal. And I just keep, you know, I don't, whatever.
That's a great stance, and it's a great approach. I tend to also just like, just because it means a lot, particularly to creative people, when their friends validate them and acknowledge them, or buy a CD, or show up to their show. Like, there was this one local dude, a guitarist. He was never very nice to anybody, and me in particular. You know, he was just kind of mean, a mean guy. And I bought his CD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever. Yeah, yeah. It was $7. And he's always been, like, extremely happy to see me ever since I bought his CD. Anyway,
You might have been the only one.
It's possible, but it means a lot to us mm-hmm. when people show up or say mm-hmm. a kind word, because it is so difficult.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting on to your more recent project, because you've had some real legitimate success. You've scored some important television shows, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and and now, you know, you're flying around the country.
I was. Hopefully, well, I'll do it again. I mean, I have Bloomington, Indiana in September, and then there's like all these shows that were booked that got postponed. And a lot of these are film festivals, and, you know, so I don't know if where they're at. You know, it's not just about me getting rebooked. It's about, like, are they surviving, you know, and we'll see. Hopefully, yes. Because, you know, there was, like, dates all over the place.
They shut down everything.
That
plague thing we heard about?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I really enjoy, on a side note, enjoy wearing my mask. And I wear it. I wear it all the time, everywhere.
That is so...
It's weird. So when I see people complain about it, I'm like, I like it.
You are a rebel.
No, like,
you renegade.
I just like, what? I guess it's like, you know, when people like, oh, I hate eating vegetables. It's like, I like vegetables.
Yeah.
When you're a kid. No, so you know
like
what
broccoli.
I mean? Like, so it's sort of like, I don't like junk food. I'm vegan, but I like vegetables. So I guess I've always had that, like, when people say they don't like something, I'm like, I don't know. Like, I like it. I like masks.
All right, George Sarah, you mask-wearing outlaw.
No, you I wear it all the time.
Troublemaker, liking it.
I wear it all the time. I don't wear it when I'm going to perform.
Radical.
But I like the mask.
Well, so the other thing that...
That was off. I'd just throw that in there. Because I'm just saying, so I don't hear... I like the mask. You know, when they're interviewing people, like, I'm so done with it. Oh, can we get back to normal? I'm like, dude, this is normal.
Yeah. Oh, it's...
I'd rather wear a mask than diapers.
No. That's a statement I don't think that has ever been made in the history of humanity.
You know,
but that's a sentence that's just completely unique to this recording right now. Mystic Pete, George Sarah, bam.
Yeah. If I see someone wearing diapers, I'm going to walk up to him and be like, you know, you don't have to wear that, you know.
Maybe they're outraged at having to wear diapers. A 1.5-year-old.
No,
this sucks, man.
No, I'm talking adult diapers.
Oh,
no.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I love wearing adult.
Sorry, we're just going off. We're going to our
Cerebistic.
It's late in the afternoon.
Absurdist.
It's a weird hour of the day.
Well, but the point I was going to make is that the other thing artists and musicians particularly hate is promoting and trying to get people to gigs. And you send flyers to all your friends, and, you know, you spent hours and a lot of money on marketing, and 6 people show up. But not you, but, you know, this is a thing. This is horrible for all of us. But you show up at these film festivals, and there's a whole crowd of people just dying to see you. All you have to do is play the music, and they love you. That's a nice situation. I like it.
Yeah, but it took me, like, a long ways to get there, you know? It took me, you know, cause and effect. Like, I was able to score Joan of Arc and have grand performances. I pitched them the idea, and they were immediately like, yeah, because I already did a concert for them several years prior where I worked with 17 different musicians. I had different Robert Williams from Captain Beefheart played with me. I had, you know, David Jay from Bauhaus sing. You know, it was like each song had different musicians come in and out. I had a tabla player, a sikh, you know, and then I had a string quartet. No, not him.
Oh.
He was going to do it, but I had this other... And then I got that show because I did the Getty, you know, and then I got the Getty because I did this NPR station that have a morning show. They have guests on. And I performed in that, you know, and I got that because I was the first band to play at Amoeba Records when they opened in 2001. You know, so it was like this thing, right? You worked and you did this and you did this and you learn and you know. So it's sort of like. Doing the film, it's great, but it's because I scored a bunch of TV shows and several films and tons of short films, so I kind of knew what to do, and I worked with strings for 15 years by the time I got to Joan of Arc. So I kind of knew how to put it together and do that. So yes, it's great to do that, have people come, but it's also, you know, it's the whole lifetime experience and refining what you do, and you know. So
you have a guardian angel that leads you from one thing to the next. However, mm-hmm. he and or she mm-hmm. makes you work for it. The morsels of breadcrumbs are there, yeah. but oh, you're gonna earn each one.
But you know, we're all means, right? We all we work for, but we want to. You know, it's like a vocation, so it's like it's exciting. You know, it's like I can't wait to do other things and other projects and work. You know, and usually, yeah, it kind of happens. Like this last film I did, it was very unusual because they wanted like an Americana score for it, and I had written a song that had a lot of acoustics and strings and guest musicians. And then it was because of that piece that they said, we want a whole film score like this. So it's like, okay, I'll go and, you know, that sounds great. And I bought an acoustic guitar, you know, and I was like, okay, instead of writing on the keyboards, I'm going to play guitar chords and put it all. And I read a couple autobiographies. I read Johnny Marr's autobiography because I wanted to get in the mind of a guitarist. And he's like one of my favorite guitarists. And reading that truly helped, because he said when he was starting out, he would just play chords that would sound nice, and he didn't know what he was playing, and then he would just kind of like put it all together, and then he said in one of his early Smith songs, came about that way, "This Night Has Opened My Eyes," and then if you listen to it, the guitar's going up and down the neck, you know, and it's like, oh, I get it now. So I wrote a lot of stuff where I would just kind of place my fingers on the guitars, like, that sounds nice, record just that one chord. And then I'd have like 8 or 9 chords that sounded good. And then it's like, okay, which ones would sound good connected, you know? And it's like, okay, this, move that. So like, is it really, you know? And then I wrote like one of the pieces that way.
I love it.
You know, it was very like truly, yeah. And because it's guitar. And then I put a band together. I knew these jazz musicians. And I said, well, can you play America? So it's and it was good because I was coming from like the outsider, and then these guys were too, but we kind of knew, so it was like a group of musicians that were trying to reach to do something that was so unfamiliar, but because we all did it together, it meshed, you know? And it was like kind of, you know, like the drummer said, I'm going to play all the parts with brushes and not sticks. You know, things like that. It's like before even going in there, it's like, because we know that's what, you know, and I actually played, like, instead of a Rickenbacker, I played a Fender P bass on the sessions because I just felt like that would have a little bit more of a sound to that. So,
George Serra, what's your website?
GeorgeSerraMusic.com.
SARAH.
Yes, Serra, like the girl.
Okay.
George, like the G.
You know, there was a time where I was playing your album like every week because it was my DJ show, and they'd always come in late. Imagine that, DJ's late.
Yeah.
And then I'd have like 5 or 10 minutes. Your album was there. It was one of my favorite ones. Every week I'm playing Vicissitudes. Yeah. And
you know, once I was driving really late at night going home, and I was listening to your show, and you played one of my pieces, and you had a guest on, and she was doing spoken word on top of one of my pieces.
Did I do that too?
Yeah, oh. It sounded cool.
It was good.
Yeah, it was good. No, it's like, wow, thank you. You know, so cool. it was cool.
Well, I actually have to go now because I have to change my adult diaper.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I'm starting a new line of adult diaper fashion.
You are?
Oh, yeah, you know. I have my line of yarmulke fashion.
Okay.
And then adult diaper fashion. Cool. So, you know, it's a thing.
Yeah. I'll definitely, you know, I'll be a sponsor.
Good. Good.
Yeah. I'll do a YouTube video how to...
What about N95 fashion?
There's so many of those already.
Oh, like a fashionable
yeah.
one.
Yeah, like with different
lights.
Yeah, my favorite one. Yeah, I see the Joy Division ones and the different, you know, like the album covers and.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'm late on that one.
Yeah.
It is March 20th, 2022. Mystic Pete here with Catherine Allison. Hi, Catherine.
Hello, Mystic Pete.
I've known you for a long time. You've just popped up in the creative circles I'm a part of for years, and I've always been enchanted with your presence, and I'm so glad you're here in studio today so I can find out more about you and your projects.
Thanks for inviting me, Mystic Pete. I'm an actress and have always been an actress, and I studied physical theater and clowning and comedy in France after studying traditional acting in England.
Clowning?
Yeah.
Is that a thing, people?
Oh, it's absolutely a thing, yes.
It's just not some silly thing with people jumping around acting like kooks?
Please, excuse me. It's very serious. It's actually an extraordinary discipline.
So clowning, I mean, it's just like some silly thing for kids, right?
Absolutely not. I would like to correct you there, Mystic Pete.
Ooh.
Clowning is a discipline, which I had you told me before I went to Paris that I was going to come back being a clown, I would have been mortified. But the process of learning how to be a clown, which is really the process of peeling away all of the affectations that you've picked up throughout your life to reveal the vulnerable person that you really are underneath, and being able to show that to an audience in all innocence is extremely challenging, and most people give up, and most people go home from clown school crying because it's not easy. It's not easy to play as an adult without feeling you're being judged or watched. And the essence of a clown is somebody who can play and revels in playfulness and does not judge themselves or judge others. In fact, a clown might come onto a stage and do something that he thinks is funny, like throw an egg in the air and watch it fall on the ground. And the audience might not laugh. So the clown thinks to himself, aha, they don't understand that that was funny. So I better do it again, so that they can catch up. And so he might do the same thing again. And it doesn't have to be throwing. I mean, I've chosen a ridiculous example, but it could be like jumping up and down three times. He might decide that that's funny. And the audience, if they don't laugh, it's not because it's not funny, it's because they haven't quite understood that it was funny yet. So he keeps trying until they can't help themselves from laughing.
Then you just explained why I'm so frustrated as a humorist. Nobody laughs at my jokes, so they don't understand how funny I am.
Yeah.
That's what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm also extremely famous, but so nobody seems to know that. So
right.
So you have to tell them. I'm understanding now.
Yeah, you're getting it. Very good.
Well, Charlie Chaplin was a clown, I believe.
Yes.
When I was a kid, we had like Barnum and Bailey's Circus, and I think I went once or twice, and it was just like this awful experience with animals kind of being tortured.
Mm-hmm.
Elephant. But then along came Cirque du Soleil, and there was this whole different kind of clown, and we went like, oh, this can be kind of a sophisticated, subtle, artistic kind of thing.
Yes.
Sounds like that's the direction you're going.
Yes, and that is hopefully the direction that people see my play in. It is a clown show, Madame Chocolat's Church of Chocolat. It is a clown show, but it's quite sad and serious and funny. So, and I'm a minister. Madame Chocolat is a minister, and I'm giving a sermon to the audience, educating them about chocolat and the journey of the Mayan people and the Aztecs, and how they went from being a matriarchal society to a patriarchal society, and then bringing it back to the matriarchal society again. Yeah.
Well, this just got a lot deeper than I understood. This is, you're getting indigenous on us.
Chocolat, la, la.
Chocolat. And I understand you've brought Madame Chocolat here today.
Oh my gosh. Did you have to say that, Mystic Pete? I didn't know if I was going to be going on the radio or not, but I suppose you've enticed me.
And to honor you, there is a pile of chocolate in front of us.
Oh, la la, this is absolutely extraordinary. We have green and the blacks. We have Beyond Good, Sugar Pova, Lindt, of course, Cho. Organic Hershey's, whatever, matcha chocolat. Oh, Godiva. She's one of my favorites. I think I want to try a piece of the organic matcha. Oh, I touched it, so I have to have it now.
You touched it, and I see you're licking it now. So
yeah,
after that.
Oh, God. Oh, really, very tasty, but has no cacao in it.
I'm so happy to feed you chocolate.
Thank
Madame
you, darling.
Chocolat.
It's the best.
So, Madame Chocolat, talk to me.
So, Madame Chocolat's Church of Chocolat is the name of my play. Please try saying that 3 times fast, everybody. Madame Chocolat's Church of Chocolat, Madame Chocolat. I can't do it. I can't even do that.
So this sounds like a very entertaining show, not only for adults, but for children too.
Yes, it could be for children. It is not aimed at children. It surprised me that it is absolutely appropriate for children. It is. It's educational. If you want me to come to your school assembly, okay, twist my arm. Gosh, pay me lots of money and I might come. But it's working for everybody. Everybody's going to love this show. It's interactive and there will be chocolat.
I heard that there was this a bigger philosophy about world peace and solving grief and sadness and anger and violence throughout the world through Madame Chocolat. That this is like an international movement that's happening.
Oh, yes.
And it's touching people's hearts, and it's changing the way people feel.
Well, I hope so, because Madame Chocolat wants everybody to just rejoice in the simple things in life that give them pleasure. Take a moment to rejoice in the now. That's all she wants. And the chocolat. Of course. Beyond Good. This looks like a nice one. Salted caramel.
Well, because, you know, a part of me feels like, you know, what I should really do today is go out and fight a war like those people over there. We should, you know, blow up their country. And I just feel like that. But then you come over here and tell me to eat chocolate. And I don't know.
I think it would be better for the world if we all just ate a little bit more chocolate, as you say. You can eat it for breakfast and lunch and dinner. It can be incorporated into pretty much any meal or drink, and it's very good for you. And some people say it's a powerful aphrodisiac.
Well, tell me more about the philosophy of Madame Chocolat. What's the big vision here?
The big vision of Madame Chocolat is really about spending time with family and friends and creating balance in our lives. No more work without time for family and friends. No more work without time for music and dance. No more work without time for love and chocolate. Okay? No more work without time for rest.
And
that is the vision. That is the big vision.
I just don't feel like going to war as much right now after hearing that. I just don't feel like attacking other countries and blowing people up anymore.
Well, good.
I like what you're saying. It's like a better alternative to being angry.
Be kind.
There it is. That's so simple. It was right there before. And
share your chocolate. Some for you, some for me. A little bit here, a little bit there. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down the medicine. Take me to church!
That a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way. Robin feathering his nest has very little time to rest while gathering his bits of twine and twig. Though quite intent in his pursuit, he has a merry tune to toot. He knows a song will move the job along.
We are coming to the end of the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started today's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called Witness Tree. Then I interviewed George Serra, and we heard several selections from his album Vicissitudes, right before the interview St. Catherine, and then after The Struggle with Stillness. Who Sleep the Sleep of Peace, Vicissitudes, and Vicissitudes of Color. Then we just wrapped up an interview with Catherine Allison and Madame Chocolat. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the finest of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!